This program was first broadcast on Arrow FM, Wairarapa's only community access media station, and shared on Access Media with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora, everyone, and welcome to Cobblestones Chronicles. It's a delight to be with you here today on Māori Language Week, celebrating Māori language. And did you know the theme is Aki Aki Aki, which is, forgive me if my pronunciation isn't very good, but it's quite hard when you've got a Scottish accent. And that's, it's all about the languages forever. And I think that's inspiring. And I'm here to talk to you about Cobblestones Museum and also about the other things that have gone on in the past in the Wairarapa, and also I also talk about, you know, what things that might be interesting. And I do encourage you, if you're interested in anything in particular, do let me know through Cobblestones Facebook page, or you can send an email to Cobblestones Museum through the website, and I'll try and answer questions. I do have a whole team of people, lovely volunteers at Cobblestones, who try and help me find information. And I just wanted to let you know this morning that on Saturday, last Saturday the 14th, we had the groundbreaking ceremony and the blessing for our new museum, part of the museum, which is going to be a huge shed full of horse-drawn vehicles and engines that we've been given over the years. And of course, this is all about the development of the Wairarapa and the opening up of the Wairarapa, because the horse-drawn vehicles were such an important part of the opening up of the Wairarapa to European settlement. And the engine, we have the Booth engine in the engine shed, which is a huge, amazing, really interesting engine, as well as some other bits and pieces. So it was lovely to have the ceremony, and lots of people attended, including Mayor Ron Mark and Mayor Martin Connolly. And what was great as well was that we had Paora Amundsen from Papawaimarae come and bless the ground so that we can go ahead. And he did a fantastic job. And it's lovely, because one of the other things that is going to happen is that when we take the horse-drawn vehicles that are currently in the museum, so that we can display them and tell the story much more effectively in the shed, we'll also be able to give over a big part of the museum building to Papawai, so that they can tell their story of the Māori version of the story in the Wairarapa. So that's a very exciting development, because in the Wairarapa, Greytown and Papawai were known as the twin towns, because they existed side by side and helped each other. So that's a future development. I was down at Cobblestones yesterday morning and a bit in the afternoon, and they're getting on with it. They've taken out the old tree stumps that were in the way, and they've started demolishing stuff, and it's very exciting. So, woohoo, have a peek round the corner when you go down to Cobblestones. Lovely. Okay, so to start this morning, I thought I would play a lovely song from called He Kona Mai E Te Tō, because it is Māori Language Week, and I thought you might quite enjoy this one. So this is from The Featherstone Players, they were called, and it's the music of Featherstone County, Bush, Bog, Brine and Bugle, revived in 2015 by some of Featherstone's finest musicians, and there's an array of fantastic musicians on here. So here we go.
By daylight, the rebel position was surrounded by 200 Pakeha soldiers and many friendly Maoris. Attacked on three sides, he retreated to his huaris, losing many men and being himself shot dead. Thus, from the whole invading force, only 14 were left at liberty. All the rest were killed or disposed of.
Rohoahou I te ata he kona mai e te tau Rohoahou I te ata ko te whakariki. Kawea atu, aue te toa. He kona mai, e te tau. Kawea atu, aue te toa. Ke te whaka, he mo he mo au. Mehe mea, ka mate au. He kona mai, e te tau. Kama te aho I taru koe I a au.
And that was the Featherstone Players with a piece of music from former times, for time of Bush, Bog, Brine and Bugle. And I'm going to find out more about that piece of music because I'm not sure where it all came from. But I will let you know in a future programme. One of the things we are doing at the moment in Cobblestones is raising funds, because we have enough money to build our fantastic new huge shed. And one of the things that we'll be doing is we're going to have a big space in it to be able to hold events indoors, which is something that's a bit missing in Greytown, is a decent sized space to hold quite big events. So we'll have that available in the future. But one of the things, of course, after we built the shed, we need to do a fit out. So what we'd like to do is, if you're watching on TV, I'm holding up our appeal brochure, and you can find this online on our website. So please help us to complete the fit out of the shed. We would really appreciate it, because we want to do a really good interpretation so that people can understand how the horse-drawn vehicles really contributed to the opening up of of the Wairarapa and the development of the Wairarapa. Of course, a lot of the development of the Wairarapa was on the back of the sheep, as it was. But it would be great to be able to tell the story really, really well. So, talking about the opening up of the Wairarapa, I have been reading from Bagnall's Wairarapa book recently, and it's absolutely fascinating to see what was happening. The bit I've been reading was about the opening up of the northern part of the Wairarapa, and there was a whole lot of immigrants who were enticed to come to the Wairarapa, and this is a bit about the Norwegian and Danish immigrants. So Bagnall says, at first there was a physically painful stage of acclimatization. Some of the Swedes and Norwegians had experience of timber work back home, but the Danish labourers were accustomed only to farm work. Some could be seen working doggedly on with hands wrapped in bloodstained bandages. Now, I have to say, my husband has Swedish and Danish ancestors, and he's been to Sweden and to Denmark, and he said that one of the things he noticed was that in Denmark, there is not a tree to be seen. I mean, it's flat, it's not forested, and then Norway, I've been to Norway and Sweden, and there's, you know, huge forests. Absolutely beautiful, huge forests. But Denmark has always been flat land. So it's not surprising that the Danes didn't have experience of felling trees. However, by January 1873, some progress had been made on the roads through the village, while the bush on the main highway towards what was to be Ekitahuna was being felled one chain wide, the trees being cut level with the road for half its width. The cultivations in Weston's clearing displayed fine potatoes and a wheat crop, which was to harvest at 35 bushels to the acre. That sounds quite a good amount. No, it's not bad. The Norwegians have done well and are perfectly satisfied with their adopted country. The Danes have not turned out very valuable settlers at present. So that was very much a report back. And no wonder, because they would have been farm workers. And of course, none of the Danes or the Swedes or the Norwegians, hardly any of them, spoke any English, because it wasn't, you know, you didn't learn English at school or whatever. And the story from my husband's Swedish family is that the two brothers set off from Sweden and on a ship, and as they left home, they were given Bible in Swedish from their mother to make sure that they remained good, God-fearing young men. And then in New York, where they ended up, they had decided by then they were going to try and come to New Zealand or Australia, probably New Zealand, and they bought an English Bible. And they taught themselves English by comparing the two Bibles. So they would read a part in Danish and then in Swedish and then read a part in English. So amazing entrepreneurship that they would do well. And of course, they did do well when they came to New Zealand. They were farmers and they, as they'd been in Sweden, and they loved living here in New Zealand. And one of them found a very nice Danish girl and got married and had a very large family. I think it was about 12 children. So amazing that they did that. So there's also in Bagnall's book, there's a piece here about Dr. Peterson, who this is about how Morrisville got its name. Because the Honourable George Morrison Morris O'Rourke, who briefly Minister of Immigration, had been present when the site of Morrisville was selected, it was decided to call the settlement O'Rourkeville in his honour. More sensible counsel prevailed, although the compromise of using his forename Morris was only a degree less unfitting and unwarranted. Dr. Peterson mentioned that when the first party's sections were allocated, the only way to them was a rough walking track. A half-chain road did not take shape until September of that year, and then only led to some 40 sections. Another narrow track served the other points of the Morrisville Triangle. It was doubtless difficult enough to stay fit, clear a section, build a house and work sufficiently long on the common vegetable patch and road to earn enough to pay both the government and the grocer, with a pittance left for the family, if lucky. So the first settlers in Morrisville were a pucky lot. They were absolutely fantastic. The men, for a time, jibed at working far from base and only moved out on ministerial assistance that they had to go into the bush and camp when already beyond walking range of their cottages. If they refused, there was nothing for it but to let the men go on the sections and find work for themselves. When the implications of this potential lockout was explained, the Scandinavians accepted the fact that they must proceed to work at once. And in Cobblestones, there's a really interesting exhibition which shows a lot about the... it's called 6 Months in a Leaky Boat, and it's a lot about a Mr. Larsen who came out as a Danish settler, and he proceeded up the line to Morrisville, and we've actually got his trunk and a number of things that were in it when he arrived in New Zealand. And it's worth going to have a look at because it gives you a really good idea. And there's also a little whare, like the one that he would have lived in, which has been built into the wall so you can get an idea of what it looks like. There was a group called the Halcyone Immigrants who were destined for Morrisville South. And they were spared the 13 months long wait of their predecessors, but were less fortunate in health. Infection during the voyage, as on the England, obliged the passengers to spend some time on Somes Island, but eventually, on 21st June, the Luna ferried them to Petone Beach and off they set. There had been two deaths on the island, and a child died during the Rumataka crossing. And of course, that was one of the hazards of those days. We're talking about the 1860s onwards. Infection during the voyage on the England obliged the passengers to spend some time on Somes Island. By August, they were established in the enlarged barracks, the men breaking themselves on the road. An A.W. Carkeek was able to advise in July that some 40 sections were ready, but a legacy of illness persisted through the summer. Monroe thought it advisable to arrange Dr. Smith to visit the settlement regularly to prevent the spread of typhoid from which some were suffering. His thoughtfulness brought him a reprimand. He had attributed the migrants' poor health in part to their own carelessness and hygiene, so he was told the government could not guarantee payment to Dr. Smith. He should enforce sanitary regulations. However, Smith confirmed this necessity of his services. Typhoid was prevalent, and since September there had been three deaths. The camp drinking water was contaminated, which in conjunction with bad drainage and the need for elementary sanitary provisions made the risk of illness much greater. Even Monroe was provoked into commenting that the group as a whole was very poor and ill-provided with large families. However, after the year's end, when everyone was able to move onto his own land, things improved dramatically. Ekatahuna, meanwhile, had a more promising start. The 6,000 acres of the Manawatu Wairarapa No. 1 or Ekatahuna block had been reserved by the general government in 1871 under the aforementioned Railway Act. When this act was soon after repealed by a more comprehensive Works Act, a curious situation arose in that it reverted to the provincial government and was administered in uneasy agreement until further legislation legitimised the activities of the central authority. In February 1873, Halcombe and Munro went north from Morrisville to select a site for the 35 Scandinavian families who were coming out in the Forfarshire. The chosen spot was a mile and a half north of the Makakahi-Rumahanga dividing watershed and 16 miles from Morrisville. The immigrants were to be placed on sections, each with a 10-chain frontage to the main road, and on a rich, light, dry soil covered with bush but not very heavily timbered. Some 24 sections, each of the 40 acres, were surveyed, and by March the men were busy on the ground. Meanwhile, Monroe said that the following month they were felling bush on the road line to the Manawatu Gorge. So they were making the road up to the Manawatu Gorge. And that must have been so tough and so hard. Really, really amazing. So I'm going to play you another piece of music now. And I thought what I'd play is a piece by You, Me, Everybody. And this one is called Give It Time, which I think is very appropriate because we're talking about, you know, a lot of time while they bash their way through the bush. Here we go, Give It Time.
Go down the rail trail, follow the tracks, taking you home, taking you back down memory lane where the sun always shines. It'll get better, friend, give it time. If you're in a bad way, think of better days, think of the sun that used to shine. The rain will pass, leaving only blue skies. It'll get better, friend, give it time. Though you'll have hard times, things will get rough. Try hard to smile now, try to be tough. All the days when you're less than fine, it'll get better, friend, give it time. Life isn't easy, it throws you around. Some days you're up, some days you're down. Keep on rolling further down the line, it'll get better, friend, give it time. Down the rail trail, follow the tracks, taking you home, taking you back down memory lane where the sun always shines. It'll get better, friend, give it time.
That was You, Me, Everybody, and Give It Time. And one of the things that I'm always struck by is how bush bands in New Zealand actually sound very much like bluegrass bands who come from the United States. And, of course, bluegrass comes from Kentucky, the Appalachians, which were settled by very much by similar kinds of people who settled New Zealand. You know, that was the time when people were moving out. They were moving out from their homes, their families, you know, leaving their larger family behind, often knowing that it was unlikely they'd ever see them again. And how brave to come all the way to New Zealand. And in fact, when you think about it, 1,200 years before, our Maori families had done exactly the same thing. They'd set sail, not knowing if they'd ever be back again, and they made their way to New Zealand. Now, just, I reckon that all New Zealanders, the reason that we're all very independent is because we come from independent stock. Our forebears all came here, and they were all very go ahead and determined to make things work. So, not surprising we're independent and don't like, and you know, like to row our own course, as it were. Anyway, so to go back to the settlement at Ekitahuna and Northern Wairarapa, which I think is interesting. So they were building the road up to the Manawatu Gorge, and the settlement was taking shape, and even the Wairarapa townsfolk were impressed, according to Bagnall. When it grew too dark to work, they light big bushfires by the aid of which they continue their labours, often far into the night. They take their dinner standing up, and in a quarter of an hour are back at work again. Despite the time they were obliged to spend on wage-producing roadwork, they were still able to use an axe on their own sections. Munro, who was one of the surveyors, noted that most managed to clear from 4 to 6 acres each at an early stage, although too late to get a good burn. Those disappointments had taught them a useful lesson, while more experience and natural thriftiness would soon enable them to make comfortable homes for themselves. And when you think about it, the natural thriftiness was a necessity to be able to be here in New Zealand. The Opaki pioneers naturally tried to improve on Henry Bannister's opportunities and endeavoured to make a little from these developments for themselves. By May 1874, W.L. Dorset had erected a store at Weston's Clearing and was said to be doing good business. By this date, it was estimated that there were a total of 312 Scandinavians in the bush, of whom 83 were able-bodied working men. And then W.R. Welsh, who was the principal owner of the Opaki, planned a new town, Mulgrave, at the camp on his property at the junction of the main line and the turn off to Kopuaranga Ford. E.W. Butler surveyed the 100 acres into a quarter acre and 1 acre lots without any apparent result, although the erection of a hotel by one J. Harvey Jr. at the camp in November 1875 might have been more successful. The men themselves were concerned about more serious matters, particularly the need for a school. During the visit in 1873 of W. Christofferson, the Australian Consul General for Norway and Sweden, representations were made to him about this need, which he stressed to the superintendent. Government agreed that it would grant £100 towards a teacher's salary in the first year on conditions that the immigrants each contributed a shilling weekly. And considering how little they were earning, and, it was really subsistence farming, that was a lot of money. It was suggested that the appointees' time be divided between Morrisville and Ekitahuna, a not uncommon arrangement during this period. 4 days were to be spent in instruction at Morrisville and 2 at Ekitahuna. There was somebody called Peterson, not an ancestor of the settlement's historian, who was considered suitable and appears to have taken up duties in May. And when Munro, on the 21st of May, was asked when payment of salary was commenced, Dr. Peterson has enlarged on the extent which the labours of this educational pioneer were appreciated, but the experiment did not last a full year. It was mentioned that for some time had built up an attendance of over 30 children. However, when he claimed sixpence a week for each child, some parents took their children away, because that would have been quite a lot of money in those days, and remember that they had big families. Next time you're at Cobblestones, pop into the school, because it was a school which was near Tainui in the Wairarapa, and opened in 1903. And it was a typical one-room schoolhouse of the time, where there were, and when you look at the desk, you'll see there's all different sizes of desks. That was to accommodate all the different sizes of children, because, of course, all the kids were in one room. And the teacher boarded with the families, though there wasn't a schoolhouse, it was just a school. And the teacher would board with one of the families. They took it in turns to board. As a child, I don't know how pleased I would be to have had my teacher board with me. with my family. So, and eating meals together, you can just imagine being told to sit up straight and eat your dinner nicely. The obvious, so going on to Bagnall's explanation, the obvious solution was to bring the school under the Education Act and levy rates. Perhaps as a result, there was clearly no school in 1875 when Eliot recommended that one be opened at Morrisville. The building had been erected for the purpose on a reserve. It had hitherto been used as a schoolhouse but is now unoccupied. And in March 1877, one Loris Johnson, with automatic insurance for the institution's survival, an exceptionally large family was appointed. So it was important to have children learn their lessons so that they would be so that they would be able to at least sign their name. I know that I have a marriage certificate at home, which my mother, it was in my mother's things, and I believe it's my great-great-grandfather and grandmother's marriage certificate, because my mother was named after her great-grandmother, and she was a weaver, which of course was a very common thing for women to do in Scotland. And they would have woven in the cottages. They had the looms in the cottages. And it says, Jane Phillip, her mark. So obviously she couldn't write her name. She hadn't had enough education to be able to write her name. So that was, you know, only 3 generations ago. So it was, education was highly prized. On that note, let's have something nice and jolly. How about the Rimutaka March Ragtime, which is another early song from the Featherstone Players. I must admit, I'm really enjoying this CD, and I'd really like to thank Mike Harding for getting it for me. It's a delight, especially as I know some of the musicians on here. So this is the Rimutaka March Ragtime.
Almost 100 years ago, just about every New Zealand soldier who went off to the First World War would have spent time at a training camp on the outskirts of Featherstone.
Saving money was perhaps one of the motivations for the Rimutaka March, because, of course, if the men marched from Featherstone back to Princeton, that saved a train fare.
Rimutaka's in the morning to march us over the hill. I'm heading in to Featherstone. Tonight I'm gonna drink my fill. Start on up at the local pub. End up ragging at the Anzac Club. Rimutaka's in the morning. They'll march us over the hill. Private Puck's got a sweetheart. A water with the shining eyes. He leaves for Cross in the morning. So tonight they have to train goodbyes. His final test before going west is to coax her down into Nesbitt's nest. Private Puck's got a sweetheart.
Just over the hill, I'm heading in.
that was the Rimutaka March ragtime. And of course, that was all about people coming back over the hill from and returning from the first and the First World War. And I just want to use my Maori word of the day, because every time I come in, I pick a card from reception, and today's word is mountain, which is maunga, and it's very appropriate because the Rimutaka is really a mountain. So that's the Maori word of the day to celebrate. I'm gradually teaching myself te reo. I think it's really worth thinking about Northern Wairarapa and thinking about how the Scandinavians did such a lot to open up. They were very industrious, as we heard, just amazingly busy, and they set up and in Morrisville every year, and it's usually the first weekend in December, so you might want to check it out. There's the Morrisville Fair, and it's absolutely great fun, well worth going to. We have been up there a few times, and there's usually some really good music, some great fun things happen. They have train rides on the Barrow train, which if you haven't seen it, is well worth going to have a look at. It's a train made, it's for children. I don't think they would take adults on it. But honestly, go and see it. It's just the Morrisville Fair is a delight, full of crafty things, great food to buy, celebrating the Scandinavian heritage, you know, the different heritages, because they are quite different countries. And if you we often talk about Scandinavia and lump them all together, but in fact, Norway, Sweden and Denmark are all very different, and their languages are quite different as well. So it's worth going up to Morrisville Fair. Really, really recommend it. Okay, so it's almost time for me to finish up. And as we've been talking about the Scandinavians and the Scandinavian settlements, I'm going to play a song by my husband, Niels Gedge, because he wrote this song, My Father's People, about his ancestors. And on one side of his family, his ancestors are Danish and Swedish. So I think it's really appropriate. So here we go. Oops, no, we're not going to go because operator error. I haven't quite got... Oh, here we go. Here we go. So this is called My Father's People by Niels Gedge, and we'll play it out.
My Father's People, cleared a forest, drained all the swamps, broke in the farms by the old Tapo Road. We bailed in summer, fed out in winter, hand fed the calves. Sundays down at the hole, Mrs. Mac played the sweet by and by, and old Pop Finley was still waiting on the lawn
to lift him up
to his home in the sky. Time came, we moved to the city, packed a big truck, drove over the hill. But deep down inside, we were sons of the forest. Guess in my heart I'm living there still. Mrs. Mac, hair in a bun. Upright as her old piano. I hear her daughter is living in Sydney. Last week her grandson emailed from Rio. Those barefoot days, the shadows now, that walk so short in the high noon garden. But later today, I swear they did lengthen as the sun was setting west of Eden. There's a place I go, you can't map it on Google. Place I go, you can't get there by car. Place I go, might find my brother. And the place I go, it's a place in my heart. Sunday down at the home, Mrs. Mac played the sweet by and by. And old Pop Finley was to wait on the Lord
to lift him up to his home,
to his home in the sky.
To lift him up to his home,
to his home in the sky.
My Father's People, and the other two musicians on that are Marion Carter, who has the beautiful alto voice, and Amanda O'Connor, who has a beautiful soprano voice, and the pump organ in the background was being played by Helen Dorothy. Now, talking of cobblestones and fairs and things, I just want to let you know that there's going to be a fair at Cobblestones. And there's going to be lots of old-fashioned crafts that you can look at and have a go at. And there's also going to be some small farm animals, the kind that are still babies, but not too small. So we really are keen on showing children, particularly, what kind of animals, what look, you know, where does milk come from? And we have a wooden cow that you can try and milk it, which is vastly entertaining. It has these teats at the bottom that you can have a go at milking, and there'll be lots of fun things to do, and music, and some games for children. So come along. That's the first Saturday in October. So come along to that. Put it in the diary. It's the start of school holidays, so I'm sure it'll be great fun. And I hope to see you there. So that's it for the programme this week. Thank you very much for listening. It's been lovely talking about the history of the Wairarapa, and particularly about Cobblestones Museum. And I'll be back again in a couple of weeks' time. And stay safe, and don't drive carefully at the moment because the roads are quite slippy. Take care. Bye.